It is Saturday, the 11th day of the 9th month, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News. In the second half, your questions and comments about technology.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It's time now for... Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. So please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This theme song is donated and created by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. If you'd like to learn more about that, you can do that so from our website, geekspeak.org. If you'd like to participate on Geek Speak by making a show or some imagery, please let us know. We'd love to have your input and feedback. Geek Speak is a Creative Commons share and share alike program, which means you can reuse this content for pretty much anything you'd like without even asking us. Woohoo!
Yeah, but you have to say where it
comes from. Oh, sorry, Miles. What were you saying?
But you have to say where it comes from.
That's true. You gotta give us cred.
I think they should let us know, just so we can go check it out.
Yeah, but that's the whole point, is that they don't have to.
Well,
they don't have to ask or anything, you just use our content. You know.
Well, yeah, we won't sue them if they don't. We might be a little angry.
No, we're not going to be angry.
Yeah, right,
point.
We won't.
I'd be angry if you asked me, actually.
And we're able to do that because Creative Commons.
Because Creative Commons rocks.
Look it up.
creativecommons.org. It's like a commercial. I'm Lyle Troxel in the air, and with me, as you can hear already, is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Mr. Elam.
Good morning.
And to all our podcaster listeners, good day or good morning, good evening to Mr. Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy and sometimes Stanford instructor and currently a thespian of great note.
Yes, a great
good
note.
Day to you.
good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, sir.
Wait.
Did you open last night?
Yes, the show that we mentioned last week, Here After Here, it has to be said in that accent,
yeah,
very, very heavy. It opened last night, and it went fantastically. All the pieces came together, you know, as so often theater does. It's crazy, crazy, crazy making, and then, you know, bam, opening night, it's locked, and it's fantastic.
It's one of the things I love, knowing people that definitely did a lot of theater, and they're in Hell Week, and it's the week before the show opens, and they really think that nothing's going to work out. It's going to fall apart. And I don't know, I've done so many shows that by Thursday night, you're going, and opening night? Yeah, it's great.
It's beautiful, it's cool. Yeah.
And then Saturday, the show's horrible. I hope that doesn't happen tonight, because that's what I'm seeing. All right, let's move on. Hey, look, I got a flyer in front of me for Year After Year.
Oh.
You're like posting these all over the place?
That looks like a cool show. Can I borrow that?
All right, let's move on. Miles, since Ben and I have been chatting for 15 minutes about nothing in particular, what's going on with you?
Speaking of chatting about nothing in particular, we've got Twitter.
Ah, that's exactly what it is.
A White House correspondent was tweeting his heart attack.
No.
Yeah, that's just
his
to give
own heart attack?
What? Yes. He was having to go like, oh man, this hurts.
Wait, are you serious? Wait,
yes,
did he tweet during his heart attack, or did he tweet right after he had responded?
No, during the course of the heart attack. Like, he starts feeling ill, starts feeling a little
Is he
off.
In the White House press room? Or is he like on some plane with the president?
He's probably chilling with his BlackBerry or something.
I don't know. Sure, he was in the press room at one point. But
do you have the text? Like, what does he say?
Well, one of them is while he's in the back of the hospital or back of the ambulance on the way to the hospital, he's saying, I gotta be me, live tweeting my heart attack, beat that.
So this is like a source of pride for him.
Well, he's a reporter, of course it is.
Oh yeah, okay, that makes sense.
So
what is
Twitter, Miles?
What is Twitter?
Yeah.
Oh, existentially?
Taking a huge jump back.
I realize that we cover a lot of technology. I'm sure a large part of our audience has heard it lots of times, but don't necessarily know what it is.
It's a communication means where you get to send messages that are no longer than 140 characters.
Okay.
So think of it like text messaging, but internet-based rather than phone-based, although you can do it from your phone now. And... having conversations to the world at large or specific people in snippets no longer than 140 characters.
Yeah, so like I could tweet on GeekSpeak right now, listen live at, and then a short link or something.
Except
like that.
The live listen link is down right now, so that would.
Oh work. Yeah.
Right. Geek. The okay. idea is that you're what you're making up in lack of erudition, lack of a complete thought, you're making up for with volume.
So, but it's very frowned upon to make multiple tweets to make longer phrases, right? You don't want to do like,
yeah, they're like 90, services like
900
tweet
characters
longer.
And actually do it with multiple chunks,
right?
Your real idea is to concise what you're be very concise in what you're going to say.
Yes, in much the same way that in many internet forums there's an acronym called TL:DR, which means too long didn't read. It's basically saying, make it simpler. I don't have time to read that much, which is a sad
so
statement
sad.
About the state of things. But
wow.
But, so speaking guy, of, yeah. but speaking of Twitter and mm-hmm. talking about these little messages, these little things, a Japanese journalist was captured in Afghanistan. And they were really curious about this thing called Twitter. So if any of you are out there going, hey, what is this Twitter thing? Some militants in Afghanistan were thinking the exact same thing. And so this Japanese journalist was asked, how do you do this Twitter thing? And so he goes, oh, well, let me see that phone. And then he tweeted where he was and that he was captured.
Did he get rescued?
And he got rescued.
No
because
way.
Of a tweet.
Okay, so we shouldn't be telling anybody what Twitter is anymore, so they can save themselves with it.
That's really
but,
I mean, amazing.
But this is Twitter going into these areas where you're thinking, oh, this is this a bunch of inane little comments, and, you know, 99% of the time they probably are. But going into the equivalent of a 911 line or
sure.
the letting everyone know how you're doing, but... It's not like a text message with your phone saying, I'm okay. Yes, I was in the San Bruno fire, for example, and I'm okay. Or if you were in an earthquake or the like. It's to the whole world saying, hey, heart attack.
Strange. Very strange.
That's the whole world the other part, reads your tweets.
The other part of the Twitter thing is that you can read most of them as public, and so you can decide to subscribe to people or not. So if you wanted to subscribe to me, for example, I'm on Twitter, and you'd have to find my URL, which is my name. So twitter.com/Lyle, okay? Anyway, anybody can look at that. So as I post things, it's potentially public to people. So this journalist, I'm assuming, the Japanese journalist, had a lot of followers, and they were able to like, go, ah, and
well,
call
one of the things about a journalist is not only do you have a following of people who read your stuff, but you also have coworkers that would know where to look for
right,
you. You
right.
also have an editor that's constantly looking at your tweets to see what's going on.
Yeah, it's cool. All right, well, thank you very much for the Twitter update. You know, I think since we've done a Twitter update, we might as well do a Facebook update.
Hey, fancy that I happen to have a Facebook news story.
You know, years ago, we used to talk about like how hard drives worked, and I don't know, it seems like we talked about stuff that was more...
Like things real? That you could actually touch with your hands.
Yes, and now we talk a lot about ethereal things.
That's, like, you know, that's really
coming
true.
From someone who works with software.
I work with hardware, too.
Well, I work with the hardware, like my keyboard, you know, my mouse
software.
To write software. And no, so yeah, there is a quick update on Facebook. For once, it's not a doom and gloom, oh my God, everyone's going to have their addresses stolen, but... Doom and gloom, everyone's going to have their addresses stolen, so, you know, protect yourself, and if you want to listen to another show. No. So this story is actually just an update on how Facebook is doing. And it turns out, so there's a report that these researchers at ComScore Incorporated put out. And just to preface this, there's quite a bit of, there's quite a large margin of error because they didn't have a humongous sample size, but a pretty big one, you know, like a couple million people, I think. 2 million people. And they found that in August, people spent 41.1 million minutes on Facebook within their sample group, which is 9.9% of their web surfing minutes for that month. So people are spending about 10... So assuming that this data can be generalized or globalized or whatever, people are spending about 10% of their web surfing on Facebook, which is pretty amazing. I actually am surprised it wasn't higher, personally. It turns out that 9.6%, so just less than, within the margin of error, of people spent their time on all of Google's sites, including YouTube. So that's YouTube, Gmail, all of those.
What percentage
things.
Did that?
That was about 9.6% and 9.9% is Facebook.
And Facebook at 9.9, wow.
Yeah, and then Yahoo actually came in third, which surprised me because in my life, Yahoo has just been relegated to the past. I don't really go on Yahoo, but that's 9.1%. So these three companies are pretty close to each other. They're pretty close to neck and neck.
Something I find interesting about this, though, is, for example, with Google Instant, which they just announced, which is you don't even have to hit enter before you start getting results.
Oh, good.
Is that Google is trying to, in effect, have people spend less time on their site, it seems.
Right.
And Gmail becoming more and more efficient means that you're spending less time looking at your email and more time getting the information you need and doing something with it. Mm-hmm. Whereas Facebook seems to spend more time trying to capture you and have you not ever leave.
Right. Oh, that's true. Are they talking about the amount of time they're doing or not mm-hmm. with it?
Yeah. The amount of minutes that they spend.
Hmm. Interesting.
And the other thing that's interesting about this is the year before, they found that people spent less than 5% of their online time on Facebook. So half the amount of time.
The year before that, Facebook didn't exist.
it's amazing to me how fast Facebook has grown. And many of the news stories that I know all of us cover on Facebook are about those growing pains, you know, of jumping into a new medium and not really necessarily having a good way of testing out things like privacy and, you know, does this what method work? Does that method work? And sure. that's the concern that I have. But it's pretty interesting to see how fast it's grown.
Yeah, and this is something that I've talked about actually even just last week. I haven't logged into Facebook since June, basically since my birthday. And I am starting to rethink that. Like the idea, right now it's like I don't think that it's doing the right thing, so I don't want to support it. I don't want to put content on there so that it becomes more popular. But one, I'm not that important. It's not like I'm generating all that much content. But to ignore where everyone is is kind of like saying, I don't agree with telephones, so I'm going to not use a telephone. That's fine.
Well, it depends on how much you disagree with their policy. If you find it, you know, abhorrent to you, you shouldn't be doing it.
Well, on the contrary. If I find something abhorrent, it means that I don't put anything personal in there. All I do is post stories about how Facebook, you know.
Okay, so some, use the system to kind of subjugate it.
Right. That Although I don't think that it's absolutely horrible, but I do think it requires education. And unfortunately, where do you go to give people that education? Facebook.
They're spending at least 9% of their online time.
Right. So I may have to rethink my stance on that.
Miles' stance, to remind you, is that Facebook is doing some things that aren't very polite and aren't very appropriate. Was that a good way to say it? And you don't necessarily agree with them.
They are doing things that, in fairness, they're doing a lot of things that are just growing pains. They're doing things that no one else has done yet. I mean, they've grown to a level that a social network has never grown to before. They have a market share on the internet that people haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as such, you know, they're going to run into problems that no one else has even thought about as being
Yeah, they're at the bleeding edge, but they're also the biggest. So, you know, when they make mistakes at the bleeding edge, then the mistakes are big.
And the mistakes we're talking about have to do with, like, personal security, but also this whole walled garden idea and just having the content trapped in by one company. That, not necessarily that it's their problem. Like, they're successful and they're working and they're making their customers
happy. Yeah, they're
a business. But that idea of having content trapped in that way is a little, doesn't fit well with, like, my feeling on how information should
it's
be
It's very
managed.
Similar to Prodigy and CompuServe.
And AOL.
And AOL back in the day. And to give someone an impression of this, it's you had these walled gardens, these areas where you could have commerce or get entertainment, but they weren't the internet.
Right.
And making things open is greater than the sum of its parts.
Let's put this in this perspective. Let's say that there's a park that everybody goes to, and it's owned by a company. And you can go to the park for free, and you can do things at the park. But the park has some rules that are not exactly great. And to see anybody, you have to go into that park. So you have to decide that you want to kind of put yourself in a space where you're kind of giving up some of what you like so that you can be with people. And it, you know, you say that, you change it from a park to a country club, and you start seeing, oh, right, it has these restrictions, only some people can be in it. Now, granted, it's extremely open, but because of the restrictions, it is you are giving up some freedoms.
Right. And imagine you signed up for that country club. And it is very open for people to come in. And in fact, maybe even free.
Mm-hmm.
And people come in and you see some advertiser billboards all around there. And you just go, eh, it's free. You know, that's how they got to make their money. That's fine. But then after you've been there for a while, after you've been there for a couple of years, then they say, oh, and we're going to have someone that's like, you know, peek inside your car window, just looking around, seeing what's there. And if anyone has anything of interest, we'll start, you know, publishing that, like, hey, we have a whole bunch of cars that have MP3 players.
And by the way, in the front office, there's a list of everybody that's on and what their home phone numbers are. If you want to go look at that, you can.
So that's kind of how I feel Facebook has acted, is they started off with this area of relative safety.
Mm-hmm.
By default, when Facebook started, when you posted, only your friends could see it. And you had to explicitly say, okay, this is going to be for more and more people. And later on, I believe it was 2008, 2009, somewhere around there, they changed their policy so that it's default everyone. And not everyone understood that change. They had gotten used to how things were before.
Sure.
And people just don't have that education level to get the security
down. I think
down.
We all like talking to Facebook, and I only say that because I think we do it so much. So let's move on. But good points, Miles. Thank you. And Ben, thank you very much for that Facebook story.
Certainly.
Miles, what's going on with the NSA?
The director of the NSA has stated that the U.S. has, quote, a duty to secure the Internet.
What does that mean?
This is saying that it should have a strong role in making sure that the networks are more secure, that they should have more control over cutting different segments of that internet off to be able to – this goes along with the recent legislation to have an internet kill switch.
Yeah, we talked about the last week, right?
Right.
Right. And
– So the idea that this is a very important thing and therefore it should have some regulations.
And that the U.S. government should have a leading role in having greater control over that network infrastructure.
I hate to use the internet superhighway as the metaphor again, but of course it's similar to important things, and there's a lot of commerce that happens on it, so it's like freeways. A lot of transportation of commerce happens, and so the freeways being safe and secure for people is really important for our economy.
Right. Now, this statement is something I've heard many different times before from mm-hmm. federal officials, and I wouldn't have commented on it were it not for the fact that it also was accompanied by another story, this one covered by Wired, that the Department of Homeland Security's cybersecurity watchdogs have a huge number of vulnerabilities on their own network.
Great. So the groups that are saying we need to make this more secure actually aren't secure.
Right. Like, yeah. Physician, heal thyself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the shoemaker's children go barefoot.
Right.
I can find all sorts of different little pithy statements to go along with that. But this idea that the U.S. should take the U.S. government, federal government, should take a lead role in securing the network, when report after report has stated that when taking a security audit of different agencies out there, they consistently get low grades. They consistently get C's and D's if you were to give them a report card.
Not someone you would want to have your managing your security of your network.
Well, I see their point, but it's also along the lines of, you know what? It'd be easier to hit your own to secure up your own networks before you even moved on to the public network. So if you can prove to me that you can handle that, sure. But in the meantime, it seems like
get out.
Physician, heal thyself.
All right. Well, thank you for the security update. I want to mention something that I've been doing some Flex development using Flash Catalyst and Flash Builder, CS5.
It's a programming environment.
Programming environment, SDK environment, kind of design environment mixed. And the thing that's frustrating with these kind of tools is that it makes code, it makes change for you. Actually, text code files, big XML documents, MXML documents, a format type. It's doing these changes for you. You're not exactly sure, so you have to go look behind the scenes. It's kind of a bit of a hacking. And what I found the greatest tool ever for managing this, of course, is Miles.
I'm assuming from your listening here, it's Git.
Yeah, it's Git. Git's a source control system we've used before. We've talked about before. Miles and I think are kind of addicted to it.
Actually, have you ever talked about it on the air?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't think we have.
We talk about it a lot. But I finally got GitX.
Hold on, back up. What is Git?
What's source control?
Yeah, what is revision control? What are we talking about here?
Okay, so revision control is the idea that as you edit files, you want to keep a history of what you've edited. You also want to be able to manage what you're editing such that you can say, well, this works, and now I'm going to play with something for a while, and I want to be able to get back to that thing that worked. So I'm going to what's called a branch. You're making a kind of a virtual copy, if you will, of the files you're going to change. You play with them, and then you test along the way, and you might have multiple branches going. You might be trying different things. And the idea is that this management system kind of takes care of keeping track of all those files so you don't lose any changes or data. It's very much like having a really amazingly cool undo and redo key. It's kind of like
that. Yeah, so you can try something, and then within that branch of trying something, you can try something else and say, oh, wait, I didn't want that. Oh, wait, actually, I'm going to revert back to, you know, nodes back to the beginning and try a different thing. But then do that all simultaneously and do different parts of the document and then merge them back together at the end.
Yeah.
Right. This was popularized by different systems called RCS, CVS later on. You start off with scripts for RCS. You have commercial implementations like ClearCase and Perforce. In the open source world, you have Subversion. And Git is also open source. Git was one of the first actually, it was a latecomer to the party. You also have like Darks and Mercurial being distributed version control systems.
The idea being here is that it used to be that you'd have some repository of all the code of a company, right? And you'd have programmers, people like Miles and myself, that would go and grab some of that code, make changes, and submit it back in. And the entire time, all the code, and it's huge, like the code for like Microsoft Word, for example, is this immense application. And you have probably 300 people programming on it. So they'll have to manage that process. And the way you've normally done
that... And hopefully they're not using Visual Source Safe.
Right. Like we used to, Miles and I used to at a company. Anyway, so you have this kind of central server location that has the code, and it has the master copies, if you will. And you're getting copies of it, you're changing it, and then you're hoping that it works, and you're submitting it back, changing this master record. In this world of Git, it's all shared. So I have my own master data, and then Miles has his own master as well, and we actually merge together so that it's more of a collaborative process. No one actually owns the core of it. But also, you can be checking in and checking out without affecting other people. And that's the thing. The reason that Git's so amazing to me really has to do with its speed. It is incredibly fast. So when you have 100 documents and you've edited a couple lines and they're text kind of documents, you make a change to it, you look at Git, it knows what's changed, it shows you a difference, just the difference of what has changed, and you can see quickly what's going on. It's a great tool if you're dealing with text documents.
And previously when you had tools like Subversion or CVS, you would say, give me the latest copy. In other words, do a checkout.
Right.
And you'd sit there and you'd wait a while and you'd see some files stream by, and then you'd make your change, and then you say, okay, commit those changes, go put them back onto the repository, CVS commit, and you'd wait a couple of seconds as it churned, and then a list of files that it had changed goes
slow
up and says successful or failure.
Right.
That sounds like a really slow process.
It was boring and
it
slow.
It was.
Yeah.
And so Git, which was written by the same person who started Linux.
Linus Torvalds.
Redesigned this concept so that when you... It's so fast, you'll hit the enter key.
So fast.
Like to make a commit change, and you don't see anything happen. Like you wonder, is this broken?
Because
I just... And when you make a branch and then merge over, like you do these operations and...
Let's do a metaphor on this, because of course a lot of people aren't programmers. So I was thinking about talking about like writing a script, but that's too linear and that doesn't really fit.
Hey Lyle, I want to work on this script with you.
Yeah, but see, that's not a good metaphor because not a lot of people have done that. Think of something that people have done before.
Imagine if you... Well, something that people have done. I was thinking
of a
congressional model of you're working on some legislation, you have a chairman.
What are things in our world that we do a lot of collaboration on? Not much? Or have to redo things over and over again?
I hate working with people.
And I'm sure
Yeah,
I'm sure everyone's thinking of like, oh, why can't you think of this? This is an obvious one.
And I know.
For some reason, we're on the spot.
So
and we're
here you go. Here are the numbers. We're gonna start taking calls now. Anyway, we're gonna keep on doing news. If you have an answer to what I just said, how do you make a metaphor for source control that everybody understands? Give us a call. The phone number is 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. That's in the 831 area code. And you can call us toll-free as well. That's 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Today in the air room, it's myself, Lyle Troxell, That's me. Miles Elam, that's him.
Hello.
And Ben Jaffe, who has the Geek Bit of the Week.
I do. I want to mention a fantastic book that I think, Lyle, you got a copy of too, called Cooking for Geeks.
Oh, yeah.
By Jeff Potter. And what jogged my brain on this is I actually saw a story on Slashdot, which I'll post up to the show page whenever that
works
gets
again.
Up. Yeah. Yeah, it's having some issues. But it's a really
fantastic... I
blame Lyle. I blame Ruby on Rails.
I blame... I don't know. Anyway, so this book by Jeff Potter, published by O'Reilly Media, called Cooking for Geeks, a really great book. It doesn't just give you recipes, it tells you why things work. Like when I first got this book, I flipped open to a random page and it had this extremely elaborate chart about the particular temperatures at which different things happen when you're cooking eggs. Like
nice.
When the proteins, all of this stuff. It's just awesome. And so like it also has some unusual recipes as well. Like it has this scrambled eggs recipe, which takes about half an hour to do. Just cook them on very, very low heat.
Have you done it yet?
I haven't done it yet. I haven't found half an hour with
eggs.
The show. But yeah.
Hey, okay. So it's so funny because every day before the show, you guys all throw things at me about what we're going to be talking about. And I go, okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. And lots of times I don't like to know what it is. I don't really want to hear the story because then on air it sounds fresh and exciting. It's, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this time you said, I've got a geek bit. I was like, great, don't tell me about it. The problem is that we're going to have the author on pretty soon.
That's so, really fantastic.
So anyway, it'll be a future show. We'll talk all about food tech,
yeah.
Geek tech.
Yeah, but fantastic book. Fantastic,
all right. Again,
fantastic
book. The book is called?
Cooking for Geeks by Jeff Potter.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I believe that it's Mr. Jaffe's turn, and let's talk about space, shall we?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, we'll cover the Git thing if somebody calls with a good metaphor if we think of one. So
yeah, that
space,
sounds great.
Space it is.
Yeah, let's get out of Facebook land. I'm tired of talking about Facebook. And anyway, so the moon. We've all seen the moon. It's this big rock up in the sky that's constantly falling towards Earth. I find that really bizarre that it actually is constantly falling towards Earth. We typically think of things that fall actually get to the ground eventually, but things in orbit are technically falling, as we define falling.
Actually, it's falling away from us.
That's another story. That's another level of complexity. No, but anyway, so we've all seen the moon. Many of us may be very familiar with what that looks like. Some of us may have even looked at it through a telescope, or maybe even some of us have taken pictures of it. But I'd be willing.
Your story is interesting.
I'd be willing to bet.
Anyway, that's the moon.
I'd be willing to bet that none of you guys listening have seen the moon from the side, and that's my news story.
What do you mean, the moon from the side?
Oh, I have nothing else to say. No, actually, my news story is the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter has actually taken enough pictures that NASA has stitched together a picture of the moon from the side. Like if you were following the moon as it was orbiting around the Earth.
So the moon is what's called tidally locked. One face of it always faces the Earth. So it rotates itself once every 28 days, whatever the cycle of the moon is.
Yeah, exactly.
So you never see the dark side of the moon. That's what actually it means, the dark side of the moon, is the side that we can't see.
Although that's actually inaccurate because, you know, when the moon is...
It's metaphorically dark as a lack of knowledge.
Okay. Yeah, so we never see one side of the moon.
It sees as much sun. In fact, it sees more sun than the light side of the moon.
Does it?
Mm-hmm.
How?
It's also more heavily cratered.
Because sometimes the light side is in shadow with an eclipse of the Earth, and the other side
never is. Okay. All right. Fair enough. You got me on
anyway,
that.
Anyway, you were saying, so they have a picture of the side of the moon.
Yeah, yeah. I should correct myself. If any of the Apollo astronauts are listening to Geek Speak right now, they have seen the side of the moon. But probably they're not listening to Geek Speak. I mean, you know, why would they? No, but anyway, so...
What are you saying?
Nothing,
Buzz,
nothing.
Buzz
I'm not
is,
saying anything.
Buzz is upset right now that you just did that.
I think you should call in. That would be fun. But yeah, so the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, as the name suggests, it orbits the sun. The moon. the orbits the moon, and it takes pictures much like our satellites do take pictures of Earth, right? That's why we have Google Earth, is because we stitch all these pictures together and everything. So NASA has stitched all these pictures from the LRO together and created this big map of the moon and then mapped it onto a sphere. So it pretty much looks exactly like it would look if we were following the moon as it orbits around the Earth. Yeah, it's really, really cool. Because, I mean, I look at the moon a lot, but if you said, you know, could you identify features on the moon, I'd probably say, no, not really. I haven't really looked at it
that's his face. Yeah.
Well, I think the whole thing's made of cheese, but that's beside the point.
Miles has something to say.
And speaking of the moon, yes, there were actual moon landings. We did go to the moon. And if you want to find proof, go to the Bad Astronomy blog by Phil Plait. And if you already believe that we went to the moon, go to Bad Astronomy's the Bad Astronomy blog by Phil Plait.
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
Things, water's wet and fire's hot. Yeah. Actually, some water's not wet.
Sometimes it's... yeah. And some fire's not hot. Some things combust at very, very low temperatures. But that's our definition of hot. And that's... Well, anyway. So this has been a very long, rambling news story. But the point I was going to make is I think it's such a cool image because even though I don't feel like I could really pick out all that many features on the moon, when I look at this, one side of the moon looks familiar to me and one side does not at all. It's really, really, really cool.
I can imagine. Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, it's a fantastic image. And I actually found out about this from Phil Plait's blog, which we were just talking about, Bad Astronomy.
You know, let's make sure to link that when the website works again.
Definitely, definitely. Right, and two more quick things. One is because it's imaging it with a satellite that's above, there are little streaks that are actually black because they haven't been imaged yet, mm-hmm. but it's pretty comprehensive. And then the second thing is Phil Plait, a couple weeks ago, we covered that he actually has a television show now,
that's right.
which is awesome. So if anyone has seen that, I haven't seen it yet. Mm-hmm. I don't have a TV.
It's called Bad Universe.
Bad Universe, yeah.
All right. And just to be clear, the first definition of falling is to drop or come down freely under the influence of gravity. So the moon can't fall away from us because it's not gravity that's influencing it.
Yeah, it's not coming down. It's moving away, I think, two centimeters per year.
Sorry, what was that definition again?
Drop or to come down freely under the influence of gravity. It's just not a good term for orbital issues.
Well, it is...
To drop and come down freely. It doesn't come down. It's actually the moon's going away.
It's coming down with a negative velocity.
It's just a question of what is down. If you're in space, you don't have a steady thing about down except for it's the center of mass in a large body.
But gravity's definitely not... It's not coming closer to us because of the influence of gravity. Well, I guess it is, technically, because its orbit's slow.
No, that's what an orbit is. It's constantly trying to fall, but you have an angular velocity that...
You're talking about it's losing... It's actually going away from the moon slowly.
Yeah, 2 centimeters a year, I think, is the number.
Because it's going so fast.
It's actually exchanging gravitationally, it's exchanging energy with the Earth. So the Earth is slowing down in its rotation, 24 hours. It's actually slowing down bit by bit by bit. And the moon is actually absorbing some of that energy gravitationally. It's really crazy.
So it is by gravity it's going away from us. So I was thinking, it is by gravity. Okay. Anyway, let's go on to something that's a little less esoteric.
What is this show anyway?
I don't know. What are we doing here?
Who are we?
Who are you?
Do we have a call?
Yeah, sure we do. Let's
See.
Let's talk to Jim in Big Sur. Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
So here's the deal. I'm a photographer. I've got this 24-inch iMac, and I took out the, 2-gig cards and put in a 4-gig, and if that makes sense, if I got it right. And so I process, 120 megabyte images, and this thing takes forever to do anything. And then I get the spinning beach balls, I'm really fed up with the whole thing.
Is your iMac white or silver?
Silver.
Okay, so it's an Intel Mac. You've got something else going on. Are you shooting RAW files?
Oh, yeah.
128 megs.
Now, here's the thing. I'm thinking about moving, when I can afford it, getting a tower.
You know what? The iMac that you have is an extremely powerful machine. I don't think you're going to run into a problem. Mm-hmm. How big are your files?
And if you're having a problem, the tower may not solve it.
120 megabytes sometimes. And I want to shoot...
That's a big file.
I shoot large format, and I want to do panoramas and put...
What are you using to edit it?
Well, I use CS5, Photoshop CS5, and Lightroom.
How much RAM do you have again? Four gigs? Yeah, that should be enough.
Something's going on wrong with your machine.
I just had a guy come up.
How old is your machine?
It's a couple of years. Come up and clean it out and, you know, reset everything. And
I mean, 128 is definitely a large file for an...
They're
going to be larger than that.
Yeah.
I'm gonna you know, take three or four files.
Well, you know, right, but he should be able to do video editing, and that's far larger.
So if I went to a tower...
No, but here's the thing, Miles, is as you're dealing with the frames and such, you're never really dealing with a big...
It's over time. Yeah, if you have a 5-gig video file, it's over the course of several minutes instead of... Yeah, so
I mean, I can imagine that he's hitting the limits of what machine can do.
Well,
but it seems a little strange to me.
Yeah, if he's doing panoramas, you know, that's going to take time.
If I went to...
Here's what I would do. Yeah. This is what you should do. Take an external hard drive, put a couple of these files on it, go down to the Apple Store... Try their tower and see what the speed is like. Then also try their iMac and talk to the Genius Bar guys, because what you're running into is you're kind of going above what they normally run into, but people do these kind of files all the time. So it's possible that you are running into a hardware limitation. But the other thing is you could increase to 8 gigs of RAM. But
I would go down there
with one of those files and try to play it, because they'll have the Adobe Suite in there.
Okay.
All right?
All right. But you know, what I'm really wanting to ask about is if I get the tower, the dual-core Intel Xeon processors and all that, will I get away from the spinning beach balls and the slow processing?
That's the thing. It depends on what's going wrong. Right now, it's really confusing to us that you're even seeing a problem.
Hello?
Because
you know what? I'm so sorry. Miles, go ahead.
It's actually a little confusing to us that you're even seeing a problem. I would even question that you would need to get a whole new machine over this, because likely if you go to the Apple Store, in my opinion, if you go to the Apple Store and you try it out and one of the towers does work well, likely it's because that tower has 8 gigs of RAM rather than 4.
But you know what I would do is I really think you need to test this, and that's what I'm saying. Is that the spinning beach ball thing has to do with the machine being really busy on a task. Uh-huh. It really shouldn't be that busy on a 128 meg file. That seems strange to me. But I haven't opened up Photoshop 128 meg files on Photoshop. So one of the first things I was thinking is, well, I've got a less powerful machine than you do, and I never run into this kind of problem. But I don't have files like that. Oh, so send me a file. Then I realized I don't really want to get 128 meg file from you, because that would be kind of hard to deal with, but you could take it down to the store and then you could try the machines there.
Yeah,
I would do some research before you spend $3,000 on a new computer.
Okay.
All right,
I appreciate
Jim. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Should we take another call or should we do some more news, gentlemen?
I think we should call.
Do some calls. All right. Let's do that then. From Santa Cruz, Bill, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Ah, good morning.
Good morning.
First part was I wanted to find out if you could compare Git to Mercurial. I see most of the people that I know changing over to Mercurial and wondered why you were interested in Git. And before you get into that, the person who was just on that had some spinning disk problems. It's possible that the hard drive is starting to fail.
Yeah, totally.
And so the first thing to do would be to...
make sure that's not happening.
Yeah, and the way to do that is I have a lot of Mac clients who are photographers and graphic artists, and I've compiled SmartCTL for all of those and run that, which then will give me a breakdown of what's going on with the hard drive, whether or not there's any failures of any kinds, errors logged on the hard drive. You might want to explain that to the audience.
Bill, go ahead.
A hard drive itself has a processor inside of it, and that processor logs whether or not it's having trouble reading sectors
from a certain area in the disk.
And it logs that information. If that has happened, it will report those errors. They aren't reported to the normal Mac.
It's kind
like
of
disk utility.
Invisible errors that you've got to have a tool to look at. So what tool are you using?
I compile SmartCTL.
And of course, compile means to actually get the source code and make the application from the source code.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's also possible to download a couple other utilities like Smart Utility and a Smart Reporter or something and use those.
What you're doing is you're just taking the tools, the kind of forensic type tools, and looking at what the hard drive is telling you.
Yeah. In addition to that,
it's a good idea because a hard drive, and that's the I like the assumption you're making, Bill, because I think all of us have run into problems where computers are kind of not working real well, and then all of a sudden our hard drive crashes, right? We had months of it really not working really well, and then it fails.
Right.
And that's the thing you really want to be watching out for. So it's highly probable that Jim's machine has a hard drive problem.
And the other thing is the software that you recommended is looking at the software, the smart, on the disk. And I think Google released a report, and their findings were, I think, half. It was like a quarter or half of the disks that fail, and Google uses a lot of disks, actually have smart issues before they fail.
Right.
So even still, even if that tool turns out everything's fine, make a backup, always make a backup of all of your stuff.
Yeah, and the speed issue is going to be affected highly by a drive that's not working really well.
Now,
so what we're talking about is like inside the drive, it's going to ask for the data, and then it's going to have a problem. It's going to make a log report, and then it's going to ask for the data again from the drive, and it's going to try to get the data again. And eventually it'll get it. But because of that multiple attempts, it's really slow. And that's what we're talking about when you have a machine that's running really slow.
And just to make this equal opportunity, for the Mac, if you have Apple Care warranty, there's a utility, although I've forgotten the name of it, that like Disk Doctor or something along those lines.
Tech Tool.
Thank you, Tech Tool. Completely unlike what I had said. That will do a whole inventory of your system. I've liked it in the past. And if you're on Windows, you're going to be looking for what's called the Event Viewer.
And
that will have hard drive failures as well. That will be logged for Windows.
Well, there are smart utilities both for Mac and PC because it's drive-based. It's really not platform-based.
And one quick thought I just had for our previous caller, if you put all of your images on an external disk and try to work with them on the external disk, that might be if you see any speed increases at all, then that's good news, you know, because it'll be pulling the files from
or
there.
Or bad news if you consider your hard drive failing.
There could be a problem with that, too, it's pulling out parts of Photoshop to bring them in to do the work.
It'll be...
you got to copy it to your cache on top of that.
Luckily, though, I mean, with 4 gigs of RAM, it's not going to be paging the disk at all, but still Photoshop's on the main disk, so...
Okay, so...
Thank you so much for calling in with
feedback.
That. And reward for that, I'll talk about some of the differences between Git and Mercurial.
Both
of these, for everybody else, both of these are source control systems. Miles and I are both using Git and love it, and Mercurial is also...
right, and they are actually, in all honesty, they are so close to one another that it's describing whether or not you want a certain type of red apple versus another variety of red apple. It's the differences between them and most other systems is far greater than the difference between those two. Now, Mercurial is written primarily in Python, which means that if you're making event hooks, like after you do a commit, that it does a certain thing or on a certain event, or if you want to put in some little script handler for it, and you know Python, it's really easy to do. It's really accessible.
So, for example, you might say if I label this branch as publishable, you could have a script that then copies your files over to a server, things like that.
Right. And Git was far more of an amalgam of born shell script or bash scripts and C libraries. Although that's changed somewhat over time.
Right.
Mercurial had a big head start because it was Python-based of running very well on Windows, whereas Git was so highly Unix-centric for a long time that it took them a while to get onto the Windows world. At this point, I actually use Git on Windows for my primary development, so I don't consider it a big detriment.
And the reason why I use Git has to do more with the social groups that I develop in. Right, so I do a lot of Ruby on Rails development, and Git's kind of taken over in the Ruby on Rails development. Everything's up on the Git repository. Actually, GitHub, which is kind of a public repository for content. That's why I started using Git, and now I just use it for anything that I want to protect on my machine.
Yeah, as an absolute land speed test, Git is a little bit faster than Mercurial in most items. There are a few things that Mercurial is faster at, but once again, they are so fast, both of them. Like, I don't want to take away from Mercurial speed because they are so fast, everything else...
It pales in comparison. Bill, I would just recommend that if you're going to be working with other people on stuff, what they use is probably what you want to use. I mean, I think that'd be pretty fair.
They're both good options.
People are using SVN and Subversion, and because they have the tools already installed, I think Alex uses Subversion still. because that's what he has set up, and he, why move? He knows how to use it. So, except for it takes longer for him to do everything. Did that help, Bill?
Oh, yeah.
Great. Thank you for the call.
For our particular purposes, we have our own custom-built version system and IDE and everything else. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't know anything about either
Bill,
one of those.
Oh, custom-built. Ooh, I'm a little scared.
Bill, what do you do?
I work for a company that develops custom chips.
Okay.
Processors, multi-core processors. We have ones that have between 4 and 144 cores on one very small chip. These are for embedded control only.
For hard drive control?
No. all sorts. could be.
Yeah,
but,
of course.
We are controlling hard drives with it, but that's a different story.
Well, thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye. Good day.
I love the variety of people we get calling in the Geek Speak. It's so cool. Like, everyone's got their own things that they're doing.
We got a call off air, and all I got is disk access, virtual memory.
That's through our Etherpad thing.
You want to talk about
it's probably similar to what we were talking about.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe paging to disk, virtual memory.
So when we talk about a cache on a disk and paging to the disk, we're talking about what is also called virtual memory.
We could also talk about a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, which really only amounts to 10 years ago and longer. there wasn't enough RAM to do everything that you want to do on your computer. And so you used your hard drive as an overflow spot.
Which is very slow compared to RAM.
Right. In fact, but it's up to a million times slower than
virtual
RAM. literally.
Literally, it's a million times slower, sure. Virtual RAM is still being used today, though.
Yes, it is, although it's not... For servers, it's definitely useful because servers can never get enough RAM. I mean, you always want to have that available. For desktops, really, it's not as important anymore.
Okay, but if I'm an activity monitor on my Mac right now in front of me, I definitely have a virtual memory column, and there's a lot of data in there. What is that about?
That is, the system will page out a bunch of items to the disk so that it can make more room for other things, like, for example, caching file access. So if you have a file that you're reading over and over again, it will save that in memory so you don't have to hit the disk in the future. And so it'll just be shifting stuff around. And so if it does have virtual memory, it will, do some housekeeping in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm assuming your laptop has like 4 gigs of RAM.
Yeah.
If you didn't have a paging file, I don't think you'd be doing all that poorly anymore.
Hmm.
I mean, 4 gigs of RAM now is... think of like 15 years ago, that was people's hard drive size.
Yeah, except like... Illustrator right off the bat's taking 300 megs. I mean,
300 megs out of 4,000 megs, which is what 4 gigs is.
All right, we had another call. How good is speech recognition right now? I'm going to say it's pretty good.
I'm doing a pretty good job recognizing what you're saying.
We're talking about voice to text.
Well,
it's pretty good.
It depends upon what you're using. For example, my iPhone with the speech recognition on there, I will say play favorites, and it'll come back playing David Bowie. And I'm like, wait, that's not what I said.
So Miles' favorite music is David Bowie. Okay, good to know. So if you want to learn more about the Cabrillo has really wonderful resources. They've got what is the name of their lab? That's set up with a whole bunch of stations of Dragon, actually speaking. And they're really friendly to let you come in, try it out, see what it's like, and get with the experts. When you're using something like Dragon, you've got to train it to your voice. So it's not a universal kind of, this is English, therefore I understand it. It's much more tonal and much more related to mapping the speaker. And then it works pretty well, I hear.
Yeah, imagine you just met someone that has a very low voice, or conversely, you meet someone that has a very high voice. Sometimes you have difficulty understanding them because you're not used to it. Yeah,
yeah.
It's exactly the same thing with a computer, only much more fine-grained, that two voices that sound very similar to us are still very different in terms of a waveform that a computer has to interpret.
I would say we are probably better at it, though.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely better than a computer.
All right.
Our tolerances end up being a lot wider then.
Let's get a real quick call, one last call in for today. From Watsonville. John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I've got my wife has a Mac Mini, older Mac Mini, and a Lacy hard drive,
mm-hmm.
Lacy hard drive. and hard drive doesn't show up anymore.
Just all of a sudden?
Well, she doesn't use it very often, so she's not even sure. The last thing we could find records of was several months ago, actually.
Can you take the LaCie and plug it into something else and have it work?
Yeah, no, that's what I did. I plugged it into my laptop.
Okay.
I created the cords, didn't get anything to work.
It's probably dead.
And, well, you can also, I mean, are you hearing it spin up, or are you not hearing anything from it?
I think it's dead. The question I had that was adjacent to this, though, is that when I go into the Apple Profiler to see what is connected, it doesn't say that it's connected, but when I was looking for, like, printers that are connected, and they show up even if they're not hooked up.
Yeah, they'll have a bit of a memory of it. But the LaCie is not showing up if it's not having any kind of sound when you turn it on. Like, now you connect to the computer, just turning it on power.
Right.
And it's not having sound, you probably have like a power supply problem.
A bad motor.
It could be a bad motor, it could be a power supply. It could really be that block that goes from the computer to the device broke.
So if she needs something on the hard drive, she could retrieve it.
Yeah, most likely. I mean, it could be that the hard drive is fine. It could be that you could open up the case and put that hard drive in a new enclosure.
Okay. That could happen.
Yeah. Good luck on it. Thing is, I have actually opened up LaCie before and found that they weren't soldered correctly, and I had to re-solder them. So, if you have somebody around.
If you're feeling ambitious.
If you're feeling really ambitious and lucky. All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
What are we going to do when electronics don't make sound anymore?
You mean like solid-state drives?
Yeah. Okay, you push the button. Does it make a sound? No. Okay, it doesn't tell me anything. definitely when I plug in my external hard drives, I take off my headphones, I listen.
You need x-ray specs. And then you can see if the data's moving around.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember years ago we talked about those little magnetic implants you put in your skin, and you can start feeling electric waves. Just need those.
Magnetic waves. Yeah.
Electric
you can tell which way is
electric
north.
Electric waves and magnetic waves are the same thing. Electromagnetic spectrum.
Okay.
GeekSpeak on KSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP, Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Normally, everything we talk about on GeekSpeak is up on our website, and it will be soon, as soon as the website works again. Anybody? Miles, do you want to take a look at that?
Well, the Ruby on Rails stuff? That's your...
That's my bailiwack?
Yeah.
Coming up in a few minutes.
That's your playground.
Coming up in a few minutes is Car Talk. Actually, just like 60 seconds. It's Car Talk. I mean, Car Talk on KOSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund, the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County, and we appreciate their support. Someone's calling me too soon. We don't have a USB, crazy USB of the week, unfortunately, this week. Either of you have something crazy to talk about?
We found a supernova shrapnel slammed inside of a meteorite. That's kind of cool.
No way. How do you know it's a supernodal?
We don't have enough time to talk about
that. 20 seconds? Yeah, you do. Go ahead.
No. But the grain they found is less than 100
Worst
nanometers.
Close of a show ever.
100 nanometers across, itty bitty teeny tiny,
really
microscopic piece of a supernova here.
How do you know it's a supernova? That's like dry water. It doesn't make any sense. Thanks for having Lyle Trox in the air with me, Miles, and Ben.